Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
The Grand Ole Party takes center stage this weekend in the Old Dominion with a challenger to Senator Mark Warner hanging in the balance. I'm Maylily Lee. Thanks for joining us. The number one task of the state Republican convention being held in Roanoke is to choose the candidate the GOP hopes will unseat Virginia's senior senator. Four men are vying for that spot on the November ballot. They are Ed Gillespie, Shaq Hill, Tony DeTora, and Chuck Moss. And the two men here to discuss that and other state news are Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Julian Walker, staff writer for the Virginian Pilot. Now, let's start off with you, Julian. The front runner here is Ed Gillespie, Republican political strategist who served as the 61st chairman of the RNC, senior advisor to Mitt Romney, and former counselor to the president in the George W. Bush White House. If he gets the Republican nod, what kind of threat does he pose to Warner?
Well, he's formidable in the fact that he has access to a national donor base by virtue of the fact that, as you point out, he's got White House experience, and furthermore, he's got Republican National Committee chairman experience. So he knows a national network of donors, people that he can draw cash from, and the ability to raise substantial sums of money to fund a serious campaign challenge is something that I would imagine Senator Warner and his campaign staff are not taking lightly, simply because you've got in this kind of era of politics, you've got to be able to raise money oftentimes to run an effective campaign. As we know from the 2012 race between now Senator Kaine and former Senator George Allen, that race, total spending between the candidates, third-party groups, outside groups, exceeded $80 million. This could be a barn burner of that type, of that magnitude. We'll have to wait and see. But having that kind of access to a donor base, I think, is significant. Furthermore, he's been involved in politics, unlike some of the other challengers. He, being Ed Gillespie, has been involved in politics for decades. And so he's someone, while he's never run before, he's kind of got the polish of someone who's got a national profile. Even if his name ID isn't particularly high, he's got someone with polish. And that also, I think, presents a challenge to Senator Warner.
And how common is that for someone who's been working behind the scenes throughout most of his career to step out in front?
Well, I guess it depends on the person, but it is a story that's not unfamiliar to Virginia voters, because our governor is someone who worked behind the scenes to some extent. Terry McAuliffe, who was a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, himself a longtime political money man who rose to the fore and ran for office. This was his second bid this time last year when he was successful. But he had never run for anything either, and he's now Virginia's governor.
Give us a little idea on Gillespie's place on the spectrum. Is he a centrist? Is he more right? Where would you put him?
Well, I think it depends on the person that is doing the evaluation. I think there are people within the kind of more rightward, more conservative grassroots, kind of Tea Party libertarian-minded folks within Republican circles who would perhaps question some of his bona fides and whether or not, you know, he is kind of truly part of that camp. Some people might characterize him as mainstream. I think that Mr. Gillespie would and does characterize himself as a conservative. But again, I mean, that is a definition of gradation and variation. So, you know, defining where one falls on the political spectrum, I think, is in the eye of the beholder.
Going chronologically, I also mentioned Shaq Hill a little bit from his website. Shaq's life has been one of service to others. He served our nation in the U.S. Air Force as a combat pilot. Shaq and Robin, his wife of 24 years, have 6 children. Shaq and his family recently received the 2013 Volunteer Family of the Year for the Commonwealth of Virginia. A little bit on him. Before we go to the others, tell me where he falls in this lineup. And I think this is going to end up being Shaq, Tony, and Chuck might be sort of lumped into one piece because of Ed's forefront status.
Well, I think with Mr. Hill, I think the people that support him, and he does have some ardent, passionate supporters, I think those people would say he is the real conservative in the race from their perspective. You know, they would point out that he is authentically pro-life in their mind, to the point that one of the stories that his supporters often tell is about how one of the children that he and his wife had, it was a troubled pregnancy. And they took the risk as a family, made the decision to carry through that pregnancy, you know, even when it potentially endangered his wife's life. So people who are kind of social conservatives and who are fiscal conservatives would point to Shaq Hill and say he's kind of the authentic conservative in the race. Mr. DeTora is a congressional policy advisor. Mr. Moss is a businessman. But, you know, all of them, I think that the real battle, at least as I hear it from Republicans I talk to, is potentially between Ed Gillespie and Shaq Hill. The expectation is somewhere between 3,500 and 5,000 delegates who will show up at the convention in Roanoke. Supposedly, the word is that Ed Gillespie is bringing in busloads of folks. I've heard anywhere from 5 to 10 busloads of folks. I've heard differing stories about the success or lack thereof he's had of filling those buses by bringing delegates in to vote for him. And so the real question, I think, becomes, does Ed Gillespie wants a resounding victory out of this convention? He wants to be, you know, at 60-plus percent of delegates to say, you know, I've got the momentum, the party is united behind me, let's all point in one direction and move forward to November where we can take on Mark Warner and try to unseat him. If things are tight, if he wins on the first ballot but it's closer than expected, that could suggest some weakness. If, in a worst-case scenario for the Gillespie camp, there is a plurality on the first ballot but not a clear majority and it goes to a second ballot, that could be even worse for him. And then, again, in that hypothetical scenario, if, say, DeTora and Moss, even if they don't have significant showings of delegate support, if all of their people migrated into the Shaq Hill camp in that hypothetical, that could make things even more uncomfortable.
Jeff, how do you think this year's Republican convention will compare with 2013, where we saw E.W. Jackson, Mark Obenchain, and others?
Good morning. Thank you for having me. We saw last year, and we could be reminded tomorrow in Roanoke, that within the Republican Party, at least within a Republican Party convention, the fewer people participate, the bigger the surprise. Certainly, that's what happened when E.W. Jackson snatched the nomination for lieutenant governor last year. One of the problems that Ed Gillespie has heading into Roanoke is that the elements of the Republican Party, at least as it exists on this day, are not natural constituents of Ed Gillespie. He is what Tea Partiers and libertarians would disparagingly refer to as a cocktail Republican. Maybe in an earlier day, might have been described as a country club Republican, though Ed Gillespie's origins are humble, working class. But he is very much in the embodiment, as Mark Warner is, as Terry McAuliffe is, The riches and power that one accumulates at that intersection of politics and business, the umphalos of which is Washington, D.C. So Ed Gillespie has some splaining to do to the Republican Party as presently constituted. And one would suspect that buses notwithstanding, that, again, that natural constituency for Ed Gillespie isn't the kind that gives up a pretty Saturday to sit in a stuffy auditorium in Roanoke, Virginia.
The question put to Julian was, do you think Ed Gillespie is more centrist or more right? Where would you – and he said it depends on who you're asking. Where would you put him?
Oh, I think he is, for the most part, by contemporary standards, a fairly middle-of-the-road Republican. I think his interests are primarily business and economic. A lot of this hot-button social stuff He acknowledges its importance within the Republican Party, but these are not priorities. Look at his first foray in policy after many months of emphasizing tactics, rolling out an economic plan in a conference call yesterday with reporters. It's a lot of Republican boilerplate. Lower taxes, lighter regulation, doing away with the deficit. Of course, junking Obamacare. How would this all be accomplished? He doesn't really say. And he seems to avoid a lot of the specifics about erasing the debt, doing something about lower taxation, jump-starting employment.
We're talking with Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch and Julian Walker with the Virginian Pilot. So we put Gillespie somewhere in the center, and Mark Warner is already considered a moderate. Would a Gillespie administration look much different?
Julian, what do you think? Well, it wouldn't be a Gillespie administration. It would be a Gillespie Senate office.
Well, in this climate, who's to say? I mean, I think the bigger question would be, at least in my mind, and I think, Jeff, you can jump to this as well, is whether or not a potential Senator Gillespie would be in a Republican majority in the Senate, or whether he would be part of a Republican minority if Democrats are able to hold on to the Senate. And so to me, it's really a matter of the composition of the body as opposed to the representation of one individual.
Yeah. And to that point, this is a not so subtle way of saying Ed Gillespie would go to the Senate with the intention of obstructing Barack Obama. This is what the Democrats will be saying. Someone like Mark Warner, who has his differences with the Obama administration, wants to find some common ground, wants to fashion solutions on difficult issues. There's that tiresome description that Warner gives of himself as the radical centrist. This is not how Ed Gillespie would comport himself.
We have a call from Hanover County. Good morning, Seeley.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you today?
Just great.
So, you ready for my question?
Yes, we are.
I'm an independent voter, but I think I speak for thousands of people across every side of the aisle when I say that a lot of us just think it's obscene how much money is wasted, millions and millions of dollars, on campaign ads where the candidates bold-facedly lie about each other. And I read recently that there are four or five states now in the country that have come up with an actual financial penalty for doing that if you can prove that someone is lying about you. And I wondered if Virginia would consider adopting a policy like that.
N-O. Now, you're from Hanover, so I assume you've been watching a lot of those Dave Brat era Cantor ads.
Oh, I watch all the ads of about everybody all over the state.
Are you voting in the Republican primary?
I vote every time I have an opportunity.
And for whom are you voting for the Republican nomination for Congress in the 7th District?
I'm still doing my homework. As I said, I'm an independent voter. I hate lying. And I don't like silly, sarcastic ads. I don't like negative ads. I think people should speak about what they stand for and what their platform is and stop the lying. It's just most of us just turn the channel or turn it off or don't throw them in the trash. So it's not helpful. It's a waste of millions of dollars.
To answer your question, there have certainly been discussions over the years in Virginia about greater accountability, particularly in political advertising. About the best Virginia has been able to do is require these disclaimers by the candidates themselves that they have authorized the ad. And that was a provision that was not adopted without considerable difficulty.
Well, if somebody can prove that someone has lied about them, shouldn't there be a penalty for that?
Well, I guess there is one in the court of public opinion on occasion. If there are penalties in the actual courts, that's something to be decided under the slander and libel laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
disappointing.
Go ahead.
Thank you so much for your call this morning.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Let's talk a little bit about Eric Cantor and Dave Brat. You know, here's a free market economist slash a free market thinker who is challenging Eric Cantor. And one really never thought one would see this, but painting him as a liberal who supports Obamacare and is loose on immigration and is really coming after Eric Cantor's centrist ways, which are coming out, as Celia has mentioned, in many ads, very expensive ad campaigns.
Well, I think what's interesting about it is my how quickly times change, and Jeff knows this as well. I mean, just a few years ago, going back to the midterm elections of 2010, Eric Cantor, after that cycle, was perceived as someone who was kind of the darling, at least of the freshman class of incoming Tea Party lawmakers. You know, he was seen as someone. I remember reading stories, about how much he did to fundraise for those folks, about, you know, how he had kind of taken them under his wing and really tried to embrace them. And then all of a sudden, you know, this year we see Eric Cantor, the number two Republican in the House of Representatives, you know, an eyelash away from the Speaker of the House, and potentially a future Speaker of the House himself, if he can rise and ascend to that position. And all of a sudden, now his conservative credentials are in question, and people are saying, as you point out, you know, he's pro amnesty. The critics allege, you know, he hasn't been tough enough in fighting the Obama administration. And so, to me, it's just very interesting how, you know, the triangulation of politics works, where, you know, one minute or one cycle you are part of the insurgency, and suddenly a flip switches somewhere, and you are part of the problem.
In 2010, as Julian points out, you know, Eric Cantor was considered the darling of this, you know, younger class of more aggressive conservatives. He has made no secret of his ambitions for the speakership. I think that's part of the problem, how unsubtle he has been about his dream. But one of the things that happened, of course, after the 2012 elections is that Republicans, having lost the presidency again, having suffered losses at the congressional level, despite holding the House, had a branding problem. And it was Eric Cantor who said, look, you know, we need to emphasize an agenda that spotlights relevance, what's important in people's lives. And from that point forward, he has been viewed with increasing suspicion by the very conservatives who had embraced him. One of the problems that Eric Cantor has, not unlike Ed Gillespie, is that his primary interest is business and taxation and regulation. A lot of this hot-button stuff really is of no moment to him, as Doug Wilder would say, but it keeps him in touch with the right.
That is Jeff Shapiro with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. We're also joined by Julian Walker of the Virginian Pilot. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Next week, a visit with filmmakers Adriana Trigiani and Sarah Elizabeth Timmons and the regions of the state they're featuring in their movies. Stay with us. We'll have more politics in a moment. And welcome back. Today we're discussing the upcoming Virginia Republican Convention and other issues across the state. We are joined by Julian Walker, staff writer for the Virginian Pilot, and Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. We'll probably return to the GOP convention as callers dictate. However, let's move on to the issue of the budget and Medicaid. I'm fascinated by this letter from Governor Mike Pence. And he is a Republican governor. He is a conservative. And our own governor, Terry McAuliffe, has said, look, to the Virginia House Republicans, look, even conservative Mike Pence is expanding Medicaid in his state. Fascinating.
Well, I think there are a couple things to remember. Number one, I mean, what Governor Pence has offered is an expansion of a program that's already existed in Indiana, and the growth of the Healthy Indiana Plan, what they're now calling 2.0, is pretty conservative-minded in a number of ways, although I do recall seeing a takedown in Forbes magazine that sought to undercut that notion and say it's not conservative enough, in fact. But that being said, what Governor Pence has requested is a waiver from the federal government, from CMS essentially so that he can implement that version of Medicaid expansion in Indiana. So permission has not been granted for that yet. But yes, Mike Pence's name has been bandied about considerably in Virginia recently, both with Governor McAuliffe offering a version of the Pence plan as a way to try to get some movement on the Medicaid expansion, which is a priority for him. And then House Republicans who are opposed to Medicaid expansion have, of course, tossed out their own letter from Mike Pence saying, yes, we've spoken to Mike Pence, but he thinks that we should do what we want to do, which is separate the budget from the Medicaid expansion discussion. So back to square one.
And I'm interested in your input as well, Jeff. First, I want to read the Pence letter. It was a pleasure to speak with you yesterday. I applaud your leadership and the efforts of Republicans in the Virginia House of Delegates to resist traditional Medicaid expansion in Virginia. I believe your stand will protect Virginia taxpayers and healthcare consumers from the long-term pitfalls of expanding this deeply flawed entitlement program. He goes on to say, Medicaid is not a program we need to expand. It is a program we need to change. As we discussed, our proposal for reform, Healthy Indiana Plan 2 incorporates a consumer-driven model to cover more low-income working Hoosiers. It is an alternative to traditional Medicaid.
And, of course, there is a private market proposal that is included in the Senate version of the budget. It has features somewhat similar to the Indiana proposal in that it requires a copay by individuals. The money from the federal government would actually be used to support these, provide subsidies essentially for these insurance companies that would be providing these options to uninsured Virginians. But there was a delicate matter for Republicans of a Republican governor, by the way, a Republican governor who had once been mentioned for the presidency, somehow being embraced by Democrats as a model for what Virginia might do. So there was a public relations problem here for House Republicans. By the way, we still don't know what House Republicans want to do about healthcare, other than throw a few extra dollars at some of the hospitals around the state.
Okay, so let's look at the budget wrangling in the GA. Where are we now?
Nowhere. and a lot of that, and that's by design. It's 24 days until the end of the month, 24 days before Virginia, absent a budget, would go over the fiscal cliff, enter terra incognita. There's a game of chicken afoot. And frankly, my sense is that maybe after Tuesday, after the primary, after the Republican tickets and the Democratic tickets are complete, you might see both sides focus a bit more purposefully on all of this.
How likely is it that we could see a shutdown of Virginia government?
I think it depends, because the real question is whether or not Terry McAuliffe, the governor, will do as he says he's going to do and continue to fund government operations, which he claims he has the authority to do. His critics say that he is making up that authority out of whole cloth and pixie dust. But I think that the options in that case would be litigation. I think if we overshoot the deadline and he says, I'm going to keep spending money absent an authorization for appropriation, he's going to say, take me to court. And then I think the political argument shifts and becomes, well, these guys are so opposed to Medicaid expansion, they will sue me to stop me from funding police and schools, et cetera, et cetera. If they agree to a budget without Medicaid expansion, then the question becomes, does Terry McAuliffe try to expand through executive fiat? And if he does that, I think the result is the same. Take me to court.
Yeah, there are some fascinating legal questions associated with this, all of the uncertainty about Virginia functioning in the absence of a budget. There was an opinion written by Bob McDonald in 2006 when Tim Kaine, then governor, was looking at a similar scenario. What happens if there isn't a budget after the 30th? And Bob McDonald, Republican, Tim Kaine, a Democrat, said that the governor was basically helpless absent the approval of a General Assembly budget. There was, however, one narrow passageway in that opinion that I assume Terry McAuliffe will cite, and that is the governor has emergency powers, and there is essentially no second guessing what constitutes an emergency. And there is some case law, some very narrow case law, that suggests that, heck, the governor could declare, as the governor did in the 70s, the gas shortage is a state emergency, and that would allow him to spend certain dollars. So stay tuned.
We brought up McDonald, so we'll talk about him not too long ago. The trial, let's call it the dividing of the trials, it was determined that Maureen and the governor, former governor, could not be tried together. They had to be separate trials, which is – oh, the other way around. Okay, so flip that. There seems to be a lot of flipping this morning. Flip that, and what's the significance of that?
Well, I think from the perspective of the defense, it is that Maureen may not testify. That was really the argument that was made at the hearing when the motions to sever the trials were brought up, and the judge decided a day later. That was just a few weeks ago. Both Jeff and I were there in the courtroom. And essentially they said there are some marital privilege issues at play here, that Maureen can testify in Bob's defense, in the former governor's defense, to undercut the testimony of the prosecution's key witness, their star witness, no pun intended there, former Star Scientific CEO Johnny Williams, and basically make the point that, or make the claim that, the governor was unaware of a lot of what Maureen was engaged in with respect to Mr. Williams. The fact that they are proceeding to trial together from the defense's perspective means that some of those options for putting on a robust defense may not be available to them.
But by standing trial together, there are certain benefits. If Bob McDonald is acquitted, there's a pretty good chance that Maureen McDonald will be acquitted. There are these issues of marital privilege and whether a spouse is shielded from the potentially adverse testimony by another. What I thought was interesting that morning in court is how matter-of-factly the prosecution indicated that regardless, it intended to call Maureen McDonald. Now, she may not have much to say under oath, and that may make it difficult for the or more difficult for the defense to refute the anticipated testimony of Johnny Williams. So it could come down to what he says and she won't.
And by way of background, for those of you just tuning in, former Governor Bob McDonald and his wife were charged back in January with improperly helping Williams promote his company in exchange for more than $165,000 worth of loans and gifts. They've pleaded not guilty. Williams is expected to be the key witness in July. And I guess one of the things that some sideline observers are wondering is it true that perhaps Maureen was much more involved and that the former governor was much less involved?
You know, I have real difficulty with this. I fear that when that point is made that, you know, we're somehow descending into gender stereotype, that it is, you know, the suggestion that somehow there's this reckless spouse here. But if you look at this as a kind of a package, it's clear that Maureen McDonald had certain interests, but it's also clear that Governor McDonald, as the technocrat he is, also understood the disclosure laws and how to interpret them so that he didn't have to make disclosures that he has since made. So when the federal government says there is something conspiratorial about this, that's a notion to which, you know, the public should pay mind.
And I think there's one other quick point just to make, which is that Bob McDonald, you called him a technocrat, Bob McDonald also has a well-earned reputation as a micromanager. And so one question to be raised is it plausible to think that someone who is such a micromanager on a professional basis has a much more hands-off policy on a personal family level?
Yeah, what Governor McDonald said when this story first broke in late March, early April of 2013, it was a very parsed response. He said, I have disclosed everything that I and my family have received from Johnny Williams in my capacity as chief executive. And the ethics law extends to the official essentially a veto. He or she can decide, well, if I receive this from someone who I deem a personal friend or a blood relation, I don't have to disclose it. Well, for purposes of disclosure, Johnny Williams for a long time apparently was a close personal friend. And it appears that that was an exemption that Bob McDonald invoked and that allowed him to conceal from the public Mr. Williams' considerable beneficence.
And this is going to take us way back. This is going to be financial disclosure 101. But we all know that Republicans and Democrats alike spend money. They go on golf trips. They have dinners and they have interaction with their lobbyists. And they disclose this.
Or not.
Or not. So can you, again, I'm taking this way down, can you explain how this differs from all of the gift giving that goes on anyway?
Well, the point that the federal government is making, and there are two, is that there was, if you will, a quid pro quo that in return for Mr. Williams' generosity, the state and the is embodied by Bob McDonald tried to help Williams' company advance this product, this wonder diet pill, Anatoblock. But there's also the issue of what the law calls honest services, that the manner in which Bob McDonald comported himself denied the people of Virginia honest services from their highest elective official. The prosecution has indicated that it's prepared to pursue this case either way. It is the defense's contention that this governor did no more than any other governor would do to assist an industry, a native industry that was trying to somehow expand its footprint.
Okay. Julian?
I think that Jeff is spot on there. I think the question is whether or not what he did was kind of not in the best interest of the people of Virginia, but self-serving and using his position to advance his own interest, or I believe as one of the prosecutors said at the hearing you and I both attended, Jeff, line his pockets.
That's Julian Walker. He is staff writer for the Virginian Pilot. We're also joined by Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Going back to the GOP convention and our discussion around that coming up in Roanoke, you know, we talked a little bit about what kind of threat Ed Gillespie might be if he is selected to Senator Mark Warner. What, if any, would be Warner's weaknesses?
Well, I think that the weaknesses, or at least perceived weaknesses, that his political opponents will try to exploit is the notion that he is too much in lockstep with the Obama administration. And when we're talking about Virginia specific issues, harkening back in some ways to the Medicaid expansion debate, because that is an outgrowth of the Affordable Care Act, is that he was, according to Republicans, the, quote, deciding vote or final vote in the Senate for Obamacare. He's going to get tagged with that. He's going to get tagged with, I believe, the percentage that Republicans use is 97% of the time he has voted for the Obama agenda. He will also get tagged as being part of the war on coal or unfriendly to coal just this week with the new EPA regulations governing emissions from existing carbon-producing or carbon-emitting power plants, including coal-fired power plants. He took a very non-committal stance on those, basically said, we need to review them some more. We need to make sure that we balance the needs of the environment with the needs of industry. That's why I support. The thing that stuck out to me from that sentence or that statement, was him saying, I applaud the administration for extending the comment period from 60 days to 120 days. It was a very non-committal response. Jeff?
Mark Warner is someone who wants to be loved. He's deeply troubled by the idea that anyone would have a difference of opinion with him. So on a lot of these issues, emissions, for example, he's always trying to split the difference. That's a good example, I think, because out in the coal fields where he's still very popular, there's a lot of concern about these suggested regs. And down in southeast Virginia along the seacoast, where the sea is rising, apparently because of climate change, there's a good deal of interest about these issues as well. But one of the things that Warner does is he kind of has these debates with himself in public. And I think that the larger issue is to somehow look like he's really at work for the people of Virginia and trying to find common ground.
Okay. And so what are the next steps? What will we be looking at just calendar-wise?
Well, I mean, I think in Virginia, I mean, the adage goes, as Jeff knows very well, you know, there's always another election in Virginia. And I think if you expand that notion to what we have seen campaigns become, it's that not only is there always another election, but the election season never dies down. That is to say that once upon a time, I recall, and I'm sure Jeff does as well, that there was sort of a summertime lull even in the midst of heated campaigns. And I think we've seen in the last couple years, last year was an example of that, there really was no cool down period. There really was no summer break. You know, the dog days of summer never arrived as far as political season is concerned.
That's Julian Walker, staff writer for the Virginian Pilot. And we're also joined by Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. You're listening to Virginia Conversations. On Virginia Public Radio, I'm Maylilly Lee, reminding you that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. And find out about upcoming topics and comment on past ones on Facebook. Search for Virginia Conversations and like us. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Welcome back to Virginia Conversations. I'm Maylilly Lee. We're talking about political news across the state. Our guests are Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Julian Walker, staff writer for the Virginian Pilot. Julian, Jeff, Virginia is one of several states where Democrats have gone to court to challenge redistricting plans drawn up by Republicans who want to keep control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Let's talk about some of the latest around that issue.
Well, the ongoing litigation, particularly pertaining to the 3rd District represented by Bobby Scott, is that minority voters, black voters, and that is a district that, for geographical perspective, snakes from Hampton Roads all the way up to the Richmond area, that black voters or African-American voters are packed into that district. And this, in fact, what's interesting to me about this is that this is an outgrowth of the last time we had a budget stalemate in Virginia. And that was because, as you recall, Jeff, there was a fight over redistricting, partisan redistricting, in 2011 that extended into 2012. And then from there, it became, you know, a fight about control of the Senate and all of the things that went along with that. And so there was a budget stalemate in that year that went on for about 40 days.
We should point out the Senate in 2012 passed a congressional redistricting plan that left the state with only one minority district out of 11 seats.
Yes. And the argument at the time for those who were opposed to that, Democrats primarily, was that there should be, based on the roughly 20% percentage share of the population that includes African Americans, was that there should be perhaps two congressional seats that had a majority of minority residents. That plan was rejected and ultimately defeated by Republicans. And that has kind of beget this lawsuit that we have now, and it's over representation of the district.
And if you were to look at this district on a map, Julian said it's snakes, and it does, but it looks more like a snake that's been run over trying to cross the road. There is a lot of political logic to these districts, in that they're all about preserving the prerogatives of incumbents, but there's not necessarily a lot of logic. The communities of interest, that's a term that is often used during redistricting. What the people within districts have in common, it's really questionable in the third district. It's questionable in a number of these districts, but that has really evaporated as a factor in drawing legislative and congressional lines. One of the big problems this creates is that the narrowest bands of the electorate have disproportionate power. So if a district is drawn to elect a Republican, generally the most conservative voters are the ones with the greatest influence. Democratic district, liberal voters are with those with the greatest influence. And the pressure is on these incumbents largely from the right and the left. And it means that the primaries or conventions are really where matters of candidacy are fully settled. It means that these incumbents are talking to these smaller groups of the electorate, the smallest groups of the electorate, and really aren't talking with each other when they get to Richmond or Washington. And that we have gridlock over healthcare is in part a consequence of redistricting.
Observers, and, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say quickly an observation. You could almost say that what you see with respect to redistricting and gerrymandered districts is a reflection of, and it almost becomes a chicken and egg question in my mind, it's a reflection of what you see in the broader populace, in the broader society, all of us self-selecting, self-segregating, choosing the news that we want to listen to, conservative or liberal. So the question I have is the public a reflection of what – of the example that we're seeing from our political leaders in that front, or is it the other way around?
Oh, there's a lot to that because, you know, as Julian and I are, you know, constantly seeing and covering politics, is that the politicians don't simply compete with each other. They have to compete with sports and nonstop news and whatever form of entertainment is available on your handheld computer. And it just becomes increasingly difficult to really engage voters on what's going on. The focus then tends to be fairly trivial, unfortunately.
Yeah, observers say that the push to redraw the district lines will be difficult in Virginia, that it's part of a bigger national battle. We should point out that every 10 years, the U.S. Census shows population movement around the country and congressional districts are redrawn so that each one has roughly the same number of people. You were giving the background on that. So typically, state legislators draw those lines. And Republicans made a big push to win control of legislatures before and after that 2010 census. Joining us now from Roanoke is David. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. What's your question or comment?
I remember many years ago when I first started paying close attention to politics, one of the Republican strategists, campaign people, famously said that you can repeat something enough times, some of the people will believe it. And I'm wondering if that was Ed Gillespie.
Ed Gillespie. Okay. Thank you for your call.
I don't specifically recall that. I mean, the name that would come to mind for me, and I'm not attributing this statement to him, would be Lee Atwater. But I don't recall. I recall generally hearing that statement, but I can't cite its source.
Nor I. And I just think it's one of the axioms of politics. One of the big problems, of course, politicians face is that a charge unanswered is a charge confirmed. And as a result, both parties, candidates in both parties, are paying much closer attention to what the other is saying and on these multiple media fronts as well. And that explains this increasingly loud chatter that's not terribly productive and sometimes not terribly enlightening.
Another news item from this week is that Virginia delegate Bob Marshall, he's wanting to pursue impeachment proceedings against Attorney General Mark Herring. This week, some African-American ministers joined him. It was part of a news conference at the state capitol denouncing Herring's decision to back two same-sex couples challenging state laws. Interesting news item.
Well, Delegate Marshall is the reliable conservative. How shall I put this?
How about this way? Remember that pop tune maybe 10 or 15 years ago, the title of which was Let's Talk About Sex?
That might be one way to characterize it. But he is the conservative cattle prod, shall we say, of the General Assembly. And he is always making sure that even members of his own caucus are kept on their toes and uncomfortable when they aren't confronting head-on the important social and culture war kind of issues that are foremost in his mind, and that includes homosexuality and same-sex marriage. He has filed resolutions to be considered by legislative committees in this special session to try to initiate impeachment proceedings against the Attorney General, primarily over his fight, as you point out, to try to overturn Virginia's prohibition on recognition of same-sex marriage. The Republican Speaker of the House, Bill Howell, has said, I'm not happy with what Mark Herring is doing, but I think it would be improper to go this path. But that, as we have learned from Bob Marshall over the years, that has not stopped or dissuaded him. He is going to keep banging the drum, whether or not it goes anywhere. The only other thing I would add is there are some questions because of the narrow scope of this special session, which has primarily been called to deal with the election of judges with the budget and arguably the Medicaid expansion piece, is whether or not those resolutions that he's filed would be properly before this special session of the legislature under the rules he contends they are. Others dispute that.
And remember, Bob Marshall has a record of success. This is the guy who initiated the lawsuit that overturned a transportation fix in 2007, 2008 that the Virginia Supreme Court unanimously declared as a glaring example of taxation without representation. So there's always this sense in the back of people's minds, particularly among legislators and elective officials, that, you know, Bob Marshall, you know, could take this where we don't want to go, and he might succeed. Of course, one of the big issues that he doesn't seem to address is that there's clear evidence that public sentiment on same-sex marriage in Virginia has changed quickly and dramatically from a state in which majority of people supported this prohibition, weaving it into the Virginia Constitution, to a majority of people saying, why are we even bothering with this?
And weaving it into the Constitution after Marshall himself pushed this effort, carried this effort. So he's got a personal stake in this as well, beyond a philosophical belief.
He wants a House of Delegates committee to investigate specifically whether Herring should be impeached for, quote, violating his oath of office. So that is to uphold the Constitution of the state. Herring's defense is, I was asked to uphold the laws of the state that are constitutional. I do not see the ban on same-sex marriage as constitutional.
That's a lawyer's job to interpret the law. Now, ultimately, the courts make that decision. But in advising a client, in this case, the governor and the people of Virginia, you know, it is the attorney general's learned opinion that the state's position is indefensible. He makes the point that Virginia should be on the right side of history this time on a matter of equal rights. It wasn't too long ago, half a century ago, that Virginia openly defied federal law by refusing to desegregate its public schools. It went all the way through the court system in its attempt to do that and failed. A Virginia governor, from Roanoke, who had been elected on a strong segregationist platform, once promising that he'd allow his right arm to be cut off before black children and white children would occupy the same classroom, famously capitulated.
I was following and thought you might go down to Loving versus Virginia, the 67 case in which interracial marriage was banned.
And the Loving case is frequently cited in the dispute over same-sex marriage.
Good morning. Mark is calling from Norfolk. How are you?
Hey, good morning to you and your guests. I just what I wanted to say is that I'm just kind of really getting a little pessimistic about our political system from a couple fronts. One is we say politics are local, which is as true gets, but the level of apathy in our voting populace, regardless of how the lines are drawn, is just diminishing. And I think what's happening is I think we, the people, the American citizenry, I think we really need to reassess what we're thinking about. You know, I just recall a time when, you know, you had politicians like Owen Pickett, and then you also had his Republican counterpart, whose name I will probably recall. But I just remember when you didn't have as much technology, but at the same time you had more accessibility to your lawmakers. And now in the advent of Internet and everything else and social media, you influence more frenzy, but you really don't get substantive things done and accomplished because you can't have a conversation without a lot of noise.
Well, we sure appreciate that comment. Thank you so much, Mark, for calling in. And also joining our conversation is Kevin from Chesapeake, who wants to chime in around Bob Marshall's comments. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning. I just wanted to say, and I forget which reporter it was who said it, but I kind of thought he was much too gentle in his characterization of Bob Marshall.
Marshall
is one of these old-fashioned, self-righteous Bible thumpers who can't see past in it or nose to realize that they've decided to join the wrong side of history. And I'm being very polite in how I characterize him.
Well, that was me. This is Julian Walker from The Pilot. And as I am a news reporter, not a columnist, so I have a little bit less latitude in offering analysis with a little bit of a spunk or a snark, which Jeff can do more freely.
Kevin, thank you so much. We go to Charlottesville now for Dave's comment. Good morning, Dave.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a comment about the Dave Brett versus Eric Cantor campaign. And, you know, to me, it seems like a big part of that campaign or a big issue is going to be the immigration issue or the illegal immigration. And, you know, Eric Cantor's really fighting, I guess, for money from the Chamber of Commerce and hence his switch stance on supporting immigration reform. But or amnesty, as it would be. And, you know, I think it's kind of not good for lower-income people in particular that have to compete against the illegal immigrants that come into the country. So in my view, Dave Brad is fighting more for the lower-income people that, you know, that stand to benefit a lot more from closing down the borders and limiting the influx of illegals. So anyhow, I just wanted to throw that out there and see what your panel's thoughts were on that.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Yeah, I think there's a big cultural difference within the 7th District of Virginia that may be a factor in this race. If you were to look at the boundaries of that district, it includes heavily suburban Henrico, part of Chesterfield and lower Hanover, and the west end of the city of Richmond. This is the natural constituency of a guy like Eric Cantor, but the rest of the district is rural and working class, and they see this fellow in his sharply tailored suits and his designer slip-ons, showing up on all the chat shows, hanging out with all the swells, and I think perhaps maybe even unintentionally generates or it's contributing to friction between the congressman and his constituents. That may be a factor here, and that may be scrambling this debate over immigration.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. Thank you for those calls. I want to thank our guests, Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist, Julian, columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Julian Walker, staff writer for the Virginian Pilot, who has less latitude. Thanks for listening and joining in today's conversation. On the next edition of the show, several recent films starring Virginia landscapes from the mountains to the shores and the women behind those film projects. We'll talk to you next time on Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.